work session rather than take a roll of that everyone is here tonight.
Except for Grace Bergen.
Oh, except for Grace. Excuse me. Commissioner Bergen is not here tonight. I didn't see her name tag around. That's why.
I didn't know. When you came back.
Okay. Well, I should have noticed. And so today we just have one work session item, which is the update on the update for the development code check-in from Mark Rust, our senior planner. Please take it away.
Good evening, Chair and Commissioners. Thank you. This is my quarterly check-in with you. There's a bit more to your packet tonight. There's a multi-page memo in here that we'll try and work through. I do have a PowerPoint presentation to present to you tonight. It's mostly pictures, and you have a copy of it in front of you as well. I think before we get started, too, our assistant city attorney would love for me to have you go around the room and do your potential conflicts of interest statements as well, so if you don't mind.
I'll start off. I own property developed and undeveloped in the city of Springfield.
And
I have no conflict of interest.
And a potential.
I have a potential conflict of interest.
You can only have a potential in this case, there's no possibility to have an actual conflict of interest in this situation.
Vice Chair.
All right. I own property in the city of Springfield, therefore I have a potential conflict of interest.
Commissioner Gill.
I own property in the city of Springfield, and I have a potential conflict of interest.
Commissioner McGinley.
I have no conflict of interest.
Commissioner Vos.
I'm a property owner in the city of Springfield, so I have a potential conflict of interest.
Commissioner Land.
I have no conflict of interest.
Thank you. Christina will be happy that we did our statements.
We did them last night as well.
So with that, what I want to do is walk through the slides pretty quickly. It's more to just provide context of some visuals of existing middle housing in the city and also some outside the area to give some perspective on some of the code provisions that are talked about in the memo, and then we'll walk through the memo and talk more about the provisions that are in there, the concepts. I will mention too that last night I attended the city council, and with basically the same presentation, same memo practically, and got some of their feedback, and I'll share that with you throughout the presentation as well. So, but let's first go through the slides and we'll go from there. So just in terms of a quick check-in on where we're at on the timeline, you've seen this timeline before. It was originally part of the community engagement plan that you, acting as a CCI, approved. We are still in the housing phase. These yellow bars, as you'll recall, are the housing phase. So we're coming up on the end of this year. The big goal at this point is this task six, to release the draft housing code sections. By the end of the year, we're shooting for just after the first of the year, hopefully, to have a draft housing code to release to the public, and then have a 6-month long public outreach process. This is that task six. And I talked a little bit with the council last night about these three items. We talked about these with you as well back over a year ago in October of 2018, how with the council's desire to have this project happen and have it happen on a fairly tight timeline, trying to figure out how to make it do the project differently is the phrase I've been kind of saying. And so within doing it differently, trying to find efficiencies in the process, and meeting those critical timeline paths. So with that, you know, there's probably processes that have happened with projects in the past that we may be going faster than some of the typical processes and things like that. And so just recognizing that I am pushing on the project to make it happen. It may not be as clean and tidy as I would even like it, but we're just trying to move forward. This is a map, and I don't think I've shared. Does this map familiar to anybody but Sophie? So Sophie's on the governance committee, so she's seen this map. And I'm primarily just presenting it as context for you all, but what I had, I worked with our GIS department and had them compile this map to represent how it might look on kind of a worst case scenario on where some of the middle housing uses could go in the city. So this light yellow area that you can kind of barely see here is all of the low density residential zone in the city. So I have all the other zones turned off. Some of what we're going to talk about tonight will also potentially be applicable to the medium density residential zone and high density residential zone. There's actually a fourth residential zone as well, the SLR zone, the small lot residential. We don't actually have any of that. There's no land actually zoned that in the city. It does exist in our zoning code. But I'm focusing primarily on the low density residential. And these two colors primarily, the green and the orange on here, are based just purely on density. Our density ranges that are adopted as part of our comp plan and also in our development code. How many units could go on those lot sizes based on density. So for a 9,000 to 12,000 square foot lot size, roughly, that is the lot size that could have a triplex, which is one of the middle housing types. And then the orange ones are 12,000 to 18,000 square feet that could have the fourplexes on them. The ones highlighted in red, which there's quite a few of, those are over 18,000 square feet. Those I'm kind of seeing as have further development potential beyond possibly middle housing, so they could probably be further divided. This does not account for if the properties are developed or not. So the thought is all of these orange and green lots, they're pretty widespread throughout the city, and that's really what I was hoping to represent is there's not necessarily one focused area where middle housing may go. It's pretty widespread throughout the city. And it doesn't account for lots that are developed with the idea that there might be some of these lots that could have a triplex that may have a single family home on it, so they could potentially add two units is the idea there. And let's see, the other thing, it does not account for what properties are annexed inside the city limits. I've actually done quite a bit more work with this map with our GIS department, mapping the properties that are inside the city limits and outside the city limits, also those that are proximate to both sewer infrastructure within 300 feet of a sewer line and also within a quarter mile of transit corridors. So we're continuing to use this as a tool, but again, primarily just trying to represent that the potential for middle housing is citywide dispersed. So,
could we get a copy of that? It wasn't in the package, correct?
It's in this PowerPoint. But yeah, I can send you the PDF of it.
I'd like to have a zoomable.
Yep, sure. Yep. I'm happy to do that.
Thank you.
There's some functionality built into the PDF that I can send you that you can actually turn layers on and off of the map from the GIS. So I can explain that a little bit in my email.
Okay, thanks.
So middle housing, we've talked about it before. The legislation that was adopted this past summer requires this city to implement middle housing. We've decided to roll that into the ongoing development code update project. And so it's a little bit, I say, kind of a kink in the path we were going down. You know, the council's intent for the big code update project in general was to simplify, make the code easier to use and understand, more streamlined process. And now implementing the middle housing uses into the process now has, in my mind, you know, raised some more questions on how we do that, particularly in the low density residential zone. So implementing these multiplexes and other middle housing types into what I'll call our single family home neighborhoods primarily. And so do we want to have provisions in the code to help with compatibility around those middle housing types or not? So those are some of the questions posed throughout the memo. And what I'll show you is just some visual examples of some existing middle housing. So this is not too far away from where we're at today in City Hall. This is a few blocks just over between 4th and 5th on C Street. So these are two triplexes. They're basically almost identical. This one has a two-car garage built on the back of it. This one doesn't. It just has parking back here. This one has a driveway running through it between the street and the alley. This one is just green space. But otherwise, they're basically the same. So this is the front of one triplex. So the doors are all facing this drive aisle. This is the second triplex. I'll show you a little bit better picture in a second. Some of the provisions talk about orientation standards, so how the front doors might be oriented. These are all oriented to the side. There's no orientation of front doors to the front. And the same with the next one. It's a little harder to see, but it's essentially the same end of the building facing the street, and then the front doors oriented to what in this case is a walkway that goes back to that rear parking area. This is another representation of a multiplex in the same general area of the city. All the front doors are oriented on this side down this walkway. So this is the street facing facade. This is a triplex. You know, this represents the doors being oriented to the street with the parking area out front. It does show some architectural details with covered entryways. This is a different area of town, so 10th and R Street. These are two basically, well, they are identical fourplex structures. This one's on a corner lot, so the orientation is a bit different versus this one, and I'll show you what I'm talking about. So this is the fourplex on the corner. The common entranceway is oriented to the street. And then because it's on a corner, the garages then are oriented to the other corner street. And then this is the other fourplex right behind it with their garages. And this is a little bit better picture of that. But because it's an interior lot or it's not on a corner, the front doors are all oriented to the side here down this walkway with the garages oriented to the street. This is another example of a fourplex. This is a duplex. This happens to be a corner lot, but they both face the one side street. This I kind of casually refer to as a snout house, where the garages are pushed out in front of the entrances. We don't regulate that now. This is another example of a duplex, where the two front doors are oriented to the street. This is a garage for the one unit on this end. This is actually the back of the garage for the unit on this side with the entrance off the side street around the back. Another duplex where the garages are almost flush with the front, so not the snout house effect, but you get the idea. And then we move out a little further east, out Main Street. Main Street's up here. You can kind of see the difference between the two zoning designations. So there's light yellow over here and a little bit darker shaded yellow. So this is our low density residential zone. This would be our medium density residential zone. These are all primarily single family homes where you get more of your existing middle housing in the medium density. However, we do allow in our existing low density residential zone duplexes on corner lots. So each one of these dots represents an address point. So you'll see there's duplexes on corner lots in a lot of these spots.
Not footprints, addresses.
Right, address points. But there's two units. Sure. There's duplexes there. Yeah, you can't really make out the footprints. But then moving more into the medium density residential zone, you'll see more four units on one lot, more duplexes. This is more of an apartment building here. There are still quite a few single family homes, but a little bit more multifamily. But here's some fourplexes on these lots. So a couple of those, this is a duplex on a corner lot. So the garage and front door entrance for this side is on this side of the corner, and the garage and front door entrance for this unit is from the other corner. Another fourplex, more of the kind of snout house effect. It is on a corner lot, but they're both facing one side. And then this is a duplex development. So these are each on their own individual lots, oriented to a private common driveway off of a public street.
two duplexes back here as well. So you have six duplexes, and this is kind of what it looks from a bird's eye view from Google Maps. And you can see, you know, they're just, they are what they are. They're duplex units. They are on separate lots. It doesn't really feel like that. It looks, or maybe feels a bit more like almost like an apartment or a complex of some sort. So now I'm going to move to a couple of out-of-town examples from the Portland area. These were used by the Department of Land Conservation and Development representing what they see as how the middle housing might be implemented. This is a block in, I guess, probably, I think it's southeast Portland. And this is the zoning map. This is kind of equivalent to our medium density residential zone. It's off of a more busy kind of street that might be equivalent to our main street. So it's a bit removed. There is a small corner of the lot that's commercial. So that's this. So there's actually some commercial uses here, but I'll show you some better pictures of how this block has been redeveloped. So this is back in 2003, the air photo for this block. They were primarily all single family homes, one here, one here, one here, and then this is a vacant spot. And then 15 years later, or just about 15 years later, the single family home that was here is gone, redeveloped with a commercial building. The vacant spot that was here is now a commercial building. And then the two single family homes that were here are now four duplexes. And so to give you some more perspective, this is the street view. So this is before. These are the two single family homes that were replaced with the four duplexes. And I'm just gonna go back again. If you look, see this house, it's still there in this picture. They're all oriented primarily to the street. This is the front of them. These are duplexes, so the main entrance for the, and I don't know the unit sizes, that could be almost that there's an ADU in a main house, but the second unit is accessed down the side, and there's a door in the side of the structure to access the second unit around back. There's one, appears to be one garage space, probably for the main unit or what might be the larger unit. This is the access to the second unit around the corner down the side. Some of what you'll see is kind of compatibility between what was the pre-existing single family homes and now the new you know, duplex structures. A couple different perspectives. So the row of duplexes, the two existing single family homes that are kind of the new units back up to. Looking from the back, you'll notice these little balconies they've built on the second floor of each one. And this is looking from the other street. This is the other single family home, showing the balconies on the second floors as well. And one more block. This is another block in Portland. I'm just highlighting kind of some infill opportunities that happen. There are two vacant spots here. And back in 2003, then again 15 years later, they've infilled this lot with a single family home, and this lot infilled with a duplex. This is the single family home in kind of a bird's eye view. You can see it's kind of compatible in height to some of the larger single family homes that existed. And then the duplex, what it looks like from the street, and then a bird's eye view next to two single family homes. So all of that, just to kind of provide a little context, and we can go back to those photos if we want throughout the discussion, but I think it provides some examples of some of the provisions that are talked about in the memo. So I'm going to just jump into that now. Are there any questions about any of that before we do jump into the memo? So the first part of the memo is the residential use table. It's still a work in progress. There are some highlighted areas that aren't all worked out yet, but I wanted to give you an idea. We're trying to simplify the residential use table, make it more broad and have larger kind of more encompassing uses that aren't so detailed or specific. So as we move forward in the next 20 years of using this code, if new
types of residential uses come along, they'll fit into kind of broader categories more easily. But I'm going to jump then to the middle housing code concepts, and the first section deals with the multiplexes. We can talk about them all together, the duplex, triplex, and fourplexes, or it may be that we want to talk about duplexes as a standalone, separate from the triplexes and fourplexes. I think there's some opportunities to look at how we treat duplexes today and how we may treat them moving forward versus triplexes and fourplexes, or we may just want to treat them all the same. And Councillor Stair is here tonight. He was in attendance at the meeting last night. I don't know if you want to give any general perspective or feedback report kind of from the council last night.
I think there were some concerns about some of the standards that were seen as being more decorative than they were functional. There were some, I think that there's just a general sense that there are certainly standards that help the functionality of the houses, and then there are also decorative features that are being listed as part of the 12, for instance, of which you can have 6 in order to meet the code. And so what we, I think, were hoping was that we could maybe streamline the standards somewhat to emphasize functionality over decorative. You know, the decorative features tend to drive up the price of the housing without necessarily increasing the livability of it.
And I'll just say that I heard some of the messaging from last night too, depending on, not to put the council as a whole, but the affordability aspect was definitely one of the points that kept coming up is,
sure,
you know, how much does each of these provisions raise the cost of providing the housing? And I don't really get into it too much in this, but just as a quick example, is parking is one of those things that tends to be the highest cost addition. So the difference between providing one parking space versus two parking spaces is a significant jump affecting the affordability of housing. And again, I don't really talk about that much in here. But every time we add a provision, whether it's like Councillor Stair mentioned, for aesthetics, you know, it's more decorative, even though it might make the unit appear, the appearance from the street more appealing to some, it's really impacting the ability to provide that at an affordable level. So I think the cost and affordability is definitely seems like a sensitive point.
Mm-hmm. Mr. McGinley.
Off of that, I'm a part of this Facebook group for small developers that do incremental development, just to gain some insight. And I posed the question of how their projects would pencil out if they had to build off-street parking. And they had quite a few examples, and I can share that with you all if that would be helpful at the next meeting.
Great. Yeah, speaking of cost, I did notice in your examples from Portland that a lot of the teardowns and rebuilds were obviously distressed and lower cost existing housing being torn down and replaced with what looked to be much higher end housing. And that, although all housing is needed, I'm not certain that that type of replacement is should really be a goal for Springfield.
Right. And I think, you know, in I mentioned to this group, I think, that I am appointed to the Rules Advisory Committee at the state level for House Bill 2001-2003. I'll also be on the Technical Advisory Committee for the rulemaking process for the middle housing standards. And talking with a number of those folks, it's pretty clear that, you know, House Bill 2001 doesn't and wasn't intended to deal with really the affordability specifically. I mean, it's generally thought that the more housing, you know, the supply and demand kind of equation, but I think that's a good point, Chair, is that I don't think it was directly meant to specifically require more affordable housing. I don't know if...
One thing to just add is that I know from talking with the land use attorney for the city of Portland, that a big reason, I mean, the market in Portland is driving a lot of that conversion, but another factor that is at work there is that the cost to retrofit an existing single-family home into multiple units is, in some cases, higher as compared to what you can get back out of that than the cost to tear it down and build new. And so part of what House Bill 2001 did was specifically in response to that issue in directing the state to develop new building code that would allow easier conversion. And so that was what that piece was aimed at, was getting at that element of the relative cost to convert versus to demolish and reconstruct.
And I'll just point back to the one example here from Portland. Again, is so these two properties that were torn down, in my mind, just as easily could have, say, torn down their little detached garage and built a second or even a duplex here. Same here, maybe you fill this in and keep your house if they were done on a lot-by-lot basis instead of, it sounds like, or it kind of appears like maybe a developer came in and bought them both and redeveloped the whole thing. But it could happen on more of an incremental basis where people are adding units instead of demolishing and replacing. So none of these regulations try and get to that, and I would imagine more the market would just dictate how those things happen. So with the multiplexes, currently in our development code, duplexes are allowed on corner lots, as long as they're 6,000 square feet and over, which is the density number to get to a 3,000 square feet per unit, basically. And there are no design requirements for duplexes today in our low-density residential zone. We do have design requirements for duplexes in our medium-density residential zone and our high-density residential zone. And that's the list that is referred to here in the memo. It's highlighted in red. It's a list of existing things that a developer can pick six of, and it's more of those aesthetics, though, and it's just the facade visible from the street. So it's dealing with how the unit looks from the street and not really addressing any potential impacts from those types of units.
Is that the list on number of 13
That's
items?
Correct.
Okay, thank
yep.
you.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that works today. Developers are used to that list. So part of the question is, should we just continue to use that list and apply it to now duplexes in the low-density residential zone, now that we're required to allow duplexes on any lot in the low-density residential zone? Or leave it alone and continue to not require any design standards for duplexes in the low-density residential zone? Or use a different set of standards, which I've proposed some as examples that I've taken from other jurisdictions that they use, that deal more with some of the potential impacts. So, you know, like the floor area ratio one could deal more with massing, potentially, of how large of a structure you're putting on a lot. Some of its aesthetics looking, you know, requiring a front porch or recessed entry. So, you know, I'm open to input or conversation about that. We can go through them in more detail if you want, or I'll turn it to you if you want to talk more about it at this point.
Mr. Gill.
For me, the aesthetic things are, I mean, I like things to look nice. But for me, it's more about massing and height and overshadowing the neighboring remaining individual houses. So like setbacks of, like, if it's three stories and the houses next to it are one story, setting back the upper story so that it's not. So those big scale things are the things that I have more concern about, the neighborhood still remaining livable. These other things I think are aesthetic but not necessarily critical. I think you showed examples of really nice looking ones on the side that don't have the entries on the street, and they look fine and they're not overbearing, and they're ones without entries on the street that look terrible. So people might disagree with me which ones look nice and which ones don't on there. So So I lean away from the requirements, especially if part of why we're doing this is to make it all easier. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's critical that, you know, we try to limit the impact to neighbors on their lots and what it does for their properties.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Sherwood.
So, for starters, having gone through the blue text, I think that it's valuable to have some standards just so that we have essentially a very broad blueprint of what duplexes can be in the city of Springfield. However, I'm in agreement with the other two opinions I've heard that the more, the less functional, the less utilitarian design standards make less sense to me. And there are a few that I wanted to point out that I want to at least ask questions on what may drive, you know, that standard. So on page 5 of 15, section B, design standards windows, mm-hmm. says either vertical or square in orientation and shape, the window must be at least as tall as each window is wide. I've seen this before. I think we were looking at ADUs. And I'm never a fan of this because I have seen many duplexes, and I think we have examples of pictures in here, mm-hmm. with windows that are wider than they are tall. And I think that when it comes down to it, a lot of regular homes that aren't duplexes have windows that are wider than tall, and I don't see any reason we should be limiting people who are living in a more affordable fashion to not be allowed to have a wide view window, which I think are actually very nice. So I'm wondering why vertical window would be required in any instance, and how do lights make horizontal windows okay if we are okay with them? Right. That's my two-pronged question about windows.
And I'll just say, I mean, I've stole this language, mm-hmm. from City of Milwaukee up in Portland. I agree with you. I think it's this provision is driving a certain aesthetic.
Exactly.
And similar to our existing list, I think the technical advisory committee meetings, we've talked at length about these existing standards, and it's almost driving a certain aesthetic. It's almost more craftsman-y, or, I mean, it doesn't have to be. We looked, in fact, Sandy and I sat down and looked at these units, and these are pretty modern-ish looking. Well, we went through this list of 13 things and checked off 6 that we think these meet. So it's not to say this variable list drives a specific aesthetic, but I think the idea that windows do is a good point. And, you know, we could just as easily say the front facade has to have 15% windows, period. Mm-hmm. And we don't care what the orientation or size or dimensions are. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's the kind of feedback I'm looking for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So mainly what I'm looking at, and I know that you did get these from other places, most of it I felt was reasonable utilitarian code, mm-hmm. most of it. So the things that I mentioned, I'm mostly just pointing out as the small list of things that I disagreed with in blue text. Otherwise, sure. I think that it's a great starting point. Mm-hmm. So the next piece I called out was on section C, front porches and entries. It says, when a covered front porch is provided for the units with the front facade facing the street, the minimum porch depth must be 6.5 feet, and the width of the porch must be at least 60% of the width of the overall length of the front facade. So a depth of 6.5 feet can make sense in a lot of ways to me, because you're talking about you have a stopping point, you get to your front door, you have something covering you. Most houses have that. I think that's a safety feature. I think that's a positive thing. However, the width of the porch being 60% of the width of the overall length of the front facade didn't make very much sense to me. Mm-hmm. I see, once again, plenty of examples of duplexes where your entire front porch is just the landing in front of your door, and the rest is just like a little bed.
Right.
And when you start requiring a bigger porch, once again, takes away from affordability. You're pouring more concrete or building something that's going to deteriorate. A lot of times it's if it's not concrete, it's a rented space, and that's going to deteriorate. So I think that a lot of places have the build-out, like you have on page 9.
Of the PowerPoint.
Yeah, page 9 of the PowerPoint, bottom slide, it's got these two garage doors, and then it's got a little dinky porch right in front of the front door. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Little dinky porch is in front of the front door with beds or shrubbery in the front. That's what I feel like most duplexes I see just on the streets in Springfield look like. That's sort of a very typical blueprint. And I think that when I envision what sounds like a fair rule for a duplex, I think about this exact blueprint. And so wide windows, not worrying about how much of the facade is 60% of this, 40% of that. That leads into the next one. Trash and recycling. It says that each unit must provide an enclosed area for trash and recycling. Now, when you're talking about fourplex, like a bigger place that has a bunch of tenants and maybe they have a communal trash plan, that would make sense, like an apartment complex, maybe even a fourplex. But with this, every one of these people are putting curbside trash and they're bringing their trash bin right in front of their garage door, like every low density residential single family house I've ever seen. So I don't think it makes sense to have separate trash and recycling. And then I think my last one was just the garage door standards, and that's on page 7 of 15. And it was talking about garage doors should not be more than 50% of the total building width. And once again, if you had like a more narrow facade on the front, and then the building itself was deeper, and you had garage doors on the front so they could have street entry, you're gonna have garage doors making it much more than 50%, especially if you have two front walk-in doors, and then the garage is similar to the snout plan that you were talking about. So some of the things like that are saying what percent you can make up of the front and things like that, in general, I would move away from those. Same sort of thing for the driveways. Some of the stuff made sense on driveways. Some of the stuff I'm thinking, you know, I'm no traffic expert. Like the 32 feet and then 16 feet. And there were all these different layouts of which street you could do what on, depending on how many different, you know, living spaces you have. So I'd like to see more explanation behind what drives the 32 and the 16 and the this street, that street type of thing. Explanation behind that would be nice.
I've actually looked more at this section since I put it in there, and also flagged it for our transportation engineer to review. But also, this may be duplicative of other provisions we have that regulate driveways and curb cuts, so it may not make sense to have in there just based on that. But I'll definitely look into that part more.
Thank you very much.
Sure, McGinley.
I had two things I wanted to talk about. The first one was the driveway standards. Sorry, I guess I'll go bottom to top. And with that, I was thinking about how having a possible 4 maximum driveways for a fourplex and how that would impact off-street parking. Or sorry, on-street parking. So if you have all of these driveways next to each other, it eliminates parking spots because now you can't park in front of a driveway. And I looked at a few examples that I could find, like in Northeast Eugene, where I saw that happening. So I just wanted to throw that out there as an idea of how on-street parking can be impacted by driveways. And then the other one, where did I write this down? For the very first criteria orientation standards under number 1. I have seen a lot of duplexes where they're long duplexes, and so it actually looks like a single family dwelling unit from the front, and then there's alley access on the side. So I wanted to suggest possibly adding that one of the units may be accessed by alley or have frontage on an alley. Anecdotally, I just learned that my friend lives in a duplex, and I visited her house so many times that I just like didn't realize because she was in the front unit. So one of those cool sneaky things. And that's it.
Okay, Commissioner Bowes.
I'm looking at the options. One of the things that I kind of think about is having some uniformity because you currently have duplexes that are permitted on corner lots, and if you develop that into a block of duplexes, you would probably prefer to have uniformity in the design standards for the entire block, rather than having the corner duplexes stand out because they're under a different set of standards. So I think I'm kind of looking at uniformity as being a plus, rather than having a different set of standards depending on where on a particular block it's located.
Okay. That sounds fine. So allowing the flexibility for them to be different, but not mandating that they be different.
Right. Okay. I mean, yeah. In other words, not having one set of duplexes clash with the appearance of the ones that were permitted under existing.
I gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I'll just mention here that, you know, a lot of this might be infill development where, again, there's an existing single-family home up front, say, and they add a unit in the backyard or on the side or convert the garage. Christina mentioned the codes that are also required to be updated to allow easier conversion of existing single-family homes internally to multiple units. So there's a number of variety. A lot of these contemplate kind of new construction on a vacant lot kind of idea, but there's going to be a lot of variability to how new units are added. So.
Yes, I'd like to say that I agree with both Commissioner Gill and Sherwood regarding the style standards. And I think what we are chasing a particular aesthetic on those. And as we did on ADUs, if we do end up requiring some of these aesthetics in whatever we end up with, I'd like to make sure that there are provisions for more creative architectural design, which both can be less expensive or it could be even greater expense, but just to not restrict people to have that particular craftsman style of house, which I know a lot of people like, but frankly, I think it's looking a little shop-worn myself. Regarding the parking, I would really like to see, now we're at about 32, 16, et cetera, driveway widths. That really lost me. And what I'd like to see would be some examples of this in a graphic nature that would show what we're thinking about on this. Because to me, it sounded as if you're just going to require the majority of the front yard or the side yard or just the majority of a lot area to be impervious concrete.
Mm-hmm.
I also noted that it seems as if we are trying to eliminate snout houses. And I think the advantage to a snout house, being a hillside resident, is that a snout house cuts way down on your costs for providing a driveway.
Mm-hmm.
And it reduces the cost of your development. If you can push your driveway closer to the street and shorten your driveway, it really cuts down on your cost major. And frankly, I don't think snout houses are necessarily that bad.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your car-oriented area. You're able to have a larger front yard than if, say, on the hillside development, if you had to shove the whole house towards the front because you didn't want a snout house, then you'd lose a lot of your front yard. So, again, I think that's an aesthetic. One other thing I had a problem with, and I'm not sure if it's just me who didn't understand this, but there was some number on page 12 of 15 that was like a something like 1 point, let's see, what was that number again? 1.618 times,
yeah.
Something. My mind just shut off when I saw that. I'm sorry.
I actually changed that in the text.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't change it in that table.
Okay.
I changed it in the text to just 1.5. So it's 1.5 times.
Mm-hmm.
That's jumping ahead to the cottage cluster housing mm-hmm. provisions. But yeah, that okay. number was changed in the text.
And then
I don't know where that was directly stolen from the city of Milwaukee out of the
okay.
Portland area. They did a very thorough examination of cottage cluster.
Then also in regard to the height, I agree with Commissioner Gill that I'm concerned with, you know, loss of solar access for neighbors, etc. I noted that daylight basements would not be included in height, and that two and a half stories beyond the daylight basement, so two regular stories, and then a residential area in a high, steep-pitched roof or something would be all allowed. If you add all that together and then put that in a hillside where your neighbor is below you, they're going to be, you know, they're going to be looking up at, it'll be a 10-degree off of vertical to, to what they're looking out, stepping out their back door, especially if we really reduce setbacks. Yeah. So those were my points.
And if I can just speak to that for a moment, you know, our both the housing code audit that we did over a year ago and, or about a little less than a year ago, I guess it was finalized, and the technical advisory committee have identified our existing solar setback standards as something that shouldn't continue to be in our code, that it's problematic and it's a barrier to development. And also that I use it as a little bit of a transition to talk about the next section after the multiplex section in here is the separation of uses, transitions, setbacks, and buffers. There's an existing for multifamily development. So current, I'll just mention here too, so our existing development code, anything over a duplex, so three units or more, is defined as multifamily. We're proposing to change that definition so it would really only apply to things over middle housing. So we would basically create a category of middle housing, and then anything outside middle housing is multifamily. So really it would be five or more units, except for cottage housing would also be middle housing. But all that to say is the existing setback requirement for multifamily, if it's adjacent to, I think I forget exactly how it reads, but basically adjacent to low density residential or single family, is a 25-foot setback. And that was also identified in both the audit and by the technical advisory committee as a barrier to development. The thought was that's too excessive. It eats up a lot of developable land. And so my direction, I felt, moving forward is to figure out how to minimize that those buffering requirements. So I talk about some of the step back provisions. I think Commissioner Gill mentioned that. You know, the council talked a bit at length about that last night. They felt that was an increased cost for construction that may not be warranted. We looked a lot at the photo of this three-story unit right up against the single family home, and they, I think, taking some of the messages I heard last night from council, is they didn't seem to necessarily think this was a big problem. Versus requiring these, I talked a little bit about, well, if we required this second story wall to be set back 3 feet and then the third story wall an additional 3 feet, that would just drive up the cost of construction, create less livable space, and you know, may not make a project pencil, kind of thing. So trying to balance all of these issues, you know, having provisions in place, not creating additional barriers to development, it's a balancing act and trying to find the place to land on all of this. One of the things we did talk about a little bit last night at council was similar to how we have this list of more aesthetic criteria today that you can choose six of, that maybe we build a different list. It might include some of these same things, but we create the list of, okay, you can optionally pick a front porch or a recessed entry, or, you know, optionally have some of these other things, oriented front door, but that we have the list that you can still pick four or six of off of a different list. Maybe we keep the same list, but and so step backs might be one of those optional types of things that could be used instead of a vegetated setback or something like that. But it's dialing all these provisions in to a point where they make sense from a compatibility standpoint and also don't drive up the cost of development. I mentioned to council last night, you know, I want to be able to have a code that is palatable or acceptable to the public as well, so we don't end up with 100 people at your public hearing when we get to that point, screaming that they can't live with this type of code because it doesn't account for their privacy or compatibility and those kind of things. So.
Commissioner Gill.
So I'd also add, I still want to pitch for the setback. But I guess I said maybe the aesthetics don't matter very much, but what I think it also does matter to not have a big flat blank wall on any side of the building. Mm-hmm. So having some sort of ratio, like you said, of window ratio or balconies or doors or indents, something so that you're not next door to a big giant flat wall.
Right, so articulation and those type of design.
Or windows, mm-hmm. or balconies, or any number of those things so that you don't have.
The balancing to that is I heard some messaging from the council again last night about, you know, not wanting one neighbor's window looking directly into the next neighbor's window. And, you know, if they're not all designed together and they're just infill projects, that's not always taken into account. But if we're requiring a certain percentage, it doesn't always, I mean, again, it's a balancing act, trying to figure out how to make that all work.
I mean, my neighbors totally look in my window, and we're single-family houses, so yeah. that's a risk everywhere.
But. No, it's not just a matter of windows, because, like, in this example, you could have instances where three-story folks are looking into the backyard mm-hmm. of the single-family, mm-hmm. and that is an intrusion in a lot of people's minds as well. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's the same issue. I think the other possibility, too, I'm looking at a list of 13, if you allow a developer to mix and match to the point where saying, I have a suggestion, there's a trade-off, something that is part of the 13, but in substitution for one that is, allow a developer enough flexibility to throw a new possibility into the mix beyond the list.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of our requirements by state law is to have clear and objective approval criteria. And so there's always the opportunity to opt in at the developer's request into a discretionary path.
Right.
So that would be them saying, I don't want to do the clear and objective path. I want to do something different, creative, and go through a discretionary process. So that, I think, is an option to build that into the code. Yeah.
Commissioner McGinley.
I've mentioned a few times, and it's a story I like to tell, but I think sometimes the term single-family residential or single-family residence or dwelling can be misleading. For my 4 years in college, I lived in single-family homes with four other people. So I wanted to know if there was any thinking about removing that language. You're doing it a bit with the missing or with the middle housing, mm-hmm. but have you ever thought about calling it like single unit? I don't know if that would mm-hmm. be better, but
yeah.
You know, there are renters and multiple renters, unrelated people that do live in single family dwellings.
Right. So we have I am working on the definitions section of the new code. One of the things we talked about last night a bit and has come up in the past is single room occupancy type. So an existing 4-bedroom house where each bedroom is rented out separately. We don't really see that as a separate use. It's still a residential use. It just happens to be the structure of how they're renting those rooms. It's not one rental agreement, it's four separate rental agreements. So we're trying to create a more of an umbrella of residential uses that encompasses more variety. And so I think that's a good point. I think the phrase or the nomenclature of single family home is pretty universal and accepted. So whether or not we try to find a different term could be interesting, but yeah, it's a good suggestion. I think I will just mention, so we're gonna run out of time, we've got about 7 minutes left, but there are a couple specific questions I have maybe, and we can think about and touch base with later, or I will just mention, so the way I've drafted the definitions for duplex, triplex, fourplex, and I may have mentioned this before, is that they don't have to be attached like traditional duplexes where it looks like two houses connected. It could be detached, kind of like ADUs are today. It could be three separate cottages. That could still be a triplex. So really I've talked about two units on one lot, three units on one lot, or four units on one lot. You know, it's not the traditional understanding of duplex, triplex, fourplex. You usually envision it's all one building. So anyway, trying to provide some flexibility there to allow creativity in how those units get developed on the property. The two points I wanted to mention and just maybe get a minute of feedback on is, one is the alley access. And so if, should we encourage or even require alley access if there are existing platted alleys and it's infill development, if they have that opportunity, and or the trade-off of trying to require development of that alley or improvement of that alley. We talked a bit about that with the ADUs, so I don't know if there's any thoughts on that topic.
Commissioner Vogt.
Well, I would say that at least require improvement if it's necessary, because many alleys are in deplorable condition, mm-hmm. and if they're the primary entryway to a multifamily neighborhood or whatever, it would probably be less desirable than just allowing people entry from the street. Mm-hmm. So I think at the minimum have conditions for the alleyway mm-hmm. that have to be met.
Okay.
Mr. Landa.
But having, and I'm agreeing with him, but in agreeing with him, I think that an alley is a good, because you have fewer ingress points onto the street. I think that's just a good idea. I was going to ask real quick, two other things real quick. Defined cluster, cottage cluster housing, what is that?
I don't know if I have a simple definition necessarily, but I can describe, I mean, I talked a bit about it last night with City Council, and that as kind of almost like if a planned unit development idea for a subdivision is familiar, this is like a microscopic version of that. It's really just a creative way to develop a site. And it kind of, the way it's written too, is it combines our existing cluster subdivision provisions. So a piece of it is the cottage piece, and so it's encouraged to have, in fact, required to have smaller units.
Okay, thank you.
So that's the cottage piece, and then the cluster piece of the name is also that you could cluster these smaller units around a common open space, potentially preserve maybe a low spot in the land or some treed area or some other undeveloped part of the property. So both the clustering aspect and what I call the cottage aspect of being smaller units, the big advantage in my mind with the way the provisions are written is that there would be no maximum density. So if they could figure out they wanted to do like tiny homes or really small cottages, and they could figure out a way to fit 10 of those on a property that would otherwise per density only allow 5 or 4 or some reduced number, they can do more units on the piece of land if they meet. It's more of a form-based code provision that allows for more flexibility and creativity of how it's done.
So what is a primary home in a cluster?
It would just be instead of an accessory dwelling unit.
Okay, it's a little bit bigger or something like that.
Well, it's so you could have 5 primary homes and potentially have an ADU attached to each one of those.
We can run a little bit long, but let's go ahead and go through the alley statement first.
I wanted to follow up on the cottage.
In a moment. Let's go ahead and answer Mark's question first, which is about the alley. I would encourage alley access in the same way. Commissioner Vogt. Commissioner Sherwood.
Oh, so just about the alleys, I was going to say that on collectors and arterials, it makes sense to require an alley to me. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking local streets where there's plenty of on-street parking, and if you put a driveway, the same people that would be parking on the street can park in that driveway, it makes less sense to require the use of housing space for alleys, and it also makes less sense because you're not as worried about high-speed movement and people popping into tons of driveways. So I think encouraging those on collectors and arterials makes more sense than enforcing them on local streets.
Huge fan of alleys. I think the city should make a commitment to alleys and not necessarily always put it on the developer. I think alleys are a huge benefit.
Commissioner McGinley.
I concur with Commissioner Gill. And I like the idea that Commissioner Sherwood proposed, but would like to see it easier and easier to have alley access on local roads as well. There's tons of alley access in our historic Washburn neighborhood, and that's where we see a lot of middle housing. And The governance committee mentioned when we met that lots of the housing types that were shown that exist in Springfield have a lot of the parking in front of the actual dwellings, and if we put it to the back, that would allow for more of that neighborhood livability feel.
Did you have further?
Well, so the other question I was going to ask for input on, kind of back to the cottage housing thing, and really it is the question about that density. So with more form-based code for that cottage housing, does this, the idea of not having a density limit, what's the thoughts on that, or just generally the cottage housing concept?
Commissioner Landon.
I think it's a good idea. I mean, the picture that she showed just kind of cements it, but it just sounded like a nice concept.
Chabot?
Well, 4 or 5 years ago, when the idea of cottage developments first was brought up in discussion, the concept that was thought of then, and that's why I'm kind of curious about the most recent definition, is that they were looking at common wall housing such as row houses, and that was fitting the definition of cottage cluster.
Right.
Now, again, it may be that, that we've gone away from that concept, but that originally was what cottage cluster housing.
But isn't that still true?
Well, I think, so my vision of cottage housing is more individual cottages, but it's written flexibly enough to allow there to be attached housing product within the cottage cluster. So you could do clusters of, you know, attached townhome type. The other is you can, the way it's written is, it, they could each be on their own individual lot, and the lot requirements in that scenario could be as small as the footprint of the structure itself. So then the, you know, it's just, then the rest is common area. So it's outside of the traditional subdivision standards as well.
Or even in a townhouse where you have a little bit of yard, but it is on separate lots.
Right, yeah.
One more thing, Mike.
Mr. Sherwood.
So I just want to call back to Mike's point earlier. It was brief, but it was about building on hills. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of hills in Springfield, a lot of hillside development. And the house I live in now is it's 3 stories, but you can only see one from the front.
Right.
So I would like to think that the max 2.5 stories, yada yada, should depend on, you know, whether or not you're on a hill. Also, porches 48 inches above grade. Things like that, considering the fact that, you know, the porch could be at different levels depending on, you know, what the landscape around the house is, and a lot of features could be. So houses are going to be on hills, both sloping toward and sloping away from.
Inside.
So I'd like to see some thought put into that for our middle housing.
That's a good point. We do have hillside development standards. But to make sure that those are still in place, you know, overriding any of the, I think the middle housing types is a good point.
Mr. Gill.
I'm all in for cottage cluster housing. Mm-hmm. I like that term because I think it makes it more clear what it is. Historically, that has been a really useful development type when more housing was needed. We can look at all different periods in U.S. history, and that was what people went to, and they're still used today, and they're great. There was some, I can't find it, so I'll try to find it for you and email it to you, but there was a part in that section that called out workforce housing specifically, and it seemed weird to me to have that in code language, like we were calling, like, yeah. And it wasn't like benefits for providing that housing or incentives or anything like that. So it was kind of strange. I lost where it is.
Yeah,
but
it might have been in the purpose or the applicability.
Yeah, I'll find it for you and let you know.
Yeah, it probably doesn't make sense to have that language in there. It sounds like to me as well.
And again, any input that we'd like to give to you, we could send you an email and CC Sandy as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
So at this point, I am, just to recap real quick, shooting for it after the first of the year to finalize the draft housing code. I will intend to go back to the City Council one more time before we release it to the public. Still trying to finalize the date for that. It's tentatively February 3rd. Our next meeting would be within the first quarter of next year. I don't know if it will be before the public release or not, but I'll definitely send it to you as a body to have and know that it's been released.
So you're not planning on taking any holiday time off?
I've got a few days here. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to be done still. Yeah. And there's a lot of work, I mean, that's been done. I didn't give it all to you for sure tonight. There's a lot of draft code in play. So.
Appreciate it. It was a great presentation. Thank you very much.
You don't have to copy me if you're emailing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just do it. Just
thanks, Mark.
Thank you. So we're adjourned for the work session. We'll take a little break.